Well, this is our last lecture, and I'm only just getting started, so I don't know what we're gonna do, but there are a whole lot of things I can talk about. And I want to begin the last lecture by saying a few general things about philosophy. First of all, I think the single most important thing is don't say anything that's obviously false. You see, you're bound to make mistakes and say some false things. But there are a lot of philosophers out there who say things that are obviously false because they think it's more spectacular, or you can make an éclat, you can make a big noise. And I'll give you half a dozen examples of the sort of thing I mean. If somebody says consciousness does not exist, I'm told that they had some guy giving this series of lectures who said that. He doesn't say those words. He says it's really just a computer program or something like that. Well, that's obviously false. We all know that from our own experience. Another related mistake is to say the mind is just a computer program. Well, we know that's false. It takes a little while to think why that's false, but you know the answer to that now. The computer program is purely syntactical, and the mind has more than just meaningless symbols. Another even worse mistake is to say all of reality is a social construction. See, we have talked in these lectures about what is a social construction. Money, property, government, marriage, universities, those are social constructions. But mountains, molecules, oceans, planets, tectonic plates, we don't construct those. They don't give a damn about us. They're there regardless of what we think. So if somebody tells you everything is a social construction, you know that's false. That's ridiculous. Another related, I told about it, there'd be half of those facilities. Another related idiotic mistake is everything is a text. This is sometimes called linguistic idealism. The only thing that's real, c'est la textualité du texte. Some nonsense sounds better in French. And maybe this is a text. Or as Derrida once wrote, il n'y a pas de texte. There's nothing outside the text. Now the strategy, and I'll talk about that in a moment, is to say something that sounds spectacular. Il n'y a pas de texte. And then when I pressed him on that, he said, well, I meant everything is in some context or other. It's not text, but context. So that spectacular claim, and nothing exists outside of the text, turns out to be the triviality. Everything's in some context or other. And that's one of the rhetorical strategies that these spectacular guys use. They say something ridiculously and spectacularly false, and then they say, well, really what I meant was something quite harmless. Now, this raises another issue that you would have to help me with, and that is there's supposed to be a big distinction between analytic philosophy and continental philosophy. And I'm not sure there is, because among my great friends in philosophy have been Jürgen Habermas and Michel Foucault. And Michel once gave a lecture in Berkeley in which he said, I am not an analytic philosopher. Nobody is perfect. That's a great remark. Anyway, I'll say a little bit about him, because he was an extremely intelligent man, a very good philosopher, died tragically, and I once asked him, pourquoi tu écris si mal? Why do you write so badly? And he was not offended, but he said something that I think is very revealing about the distinction between European continental philosophy and Anglo-American philosophy. He said, if I wrote as clearly as you do, he said, speaking to me, no one in France would take it seriously. They would think, c'est enfantin, c'est naïf. It's childish, it's naïve. And I thought, oh, tu te moques un peu de moi, you don't really mean that, seriously. And he became very excited. He's a very intelligent man, Michel. He said, en France, il faut avoir au moins 10% incompréhensible. And for those who don't speak French, he's saying, in France, you have to have at least 10% incomprehensible. Otherwise, people don't think it's deep. People think it's kind of like journalism. And I wasn't sure, was he really serious? So I gave a series of lectures at the Collège de France. And my host, was a wonderful man named Pierre Bourdieu, another very great thinker. Also very obscure. And I told this story to Pierre about un moins 10% incompréhensible, and I said, est-ce qu'il se moque un peu de moi? Was Michel just goofing off and making fun of me? And he got very excited, and he said, no, absolutely not. It's more like 20%, more like 20% incompréhensible. And when you read Pierre, it is incomprehensible. I made the mistake. His best book is called The Logic of Practice. I assigned it to my poor students in Berkeley. They couldn't make sense of it. So I gave up on those guys. What is paradoxical is they're perfectly clear in conversation. When I have a conversation with Michel Foucault or Pierre Bourdieu, it's exactly like a conversation with you or me. But when they write and publish, au moins 10% incompréhensible, I guess. Though I know, in his later years, it seemed to me that Michel was becoming much clearer. Now this raises these distinctions about continental philosophy and Anglo-American philosophy, and I'm not enough knowledgeable about publication and so on. But people have pointed out that the size of the audience in the English-speaking world, the size of the analytic philosopher's audience, is you address a really international clientele. And you, as somebody, a French philosopher, pointed out, Quine can be famous internationally. Willard Van Orman Quine, who gave these lectures, was the most famous philosopher of his generation. You can be famous internationally, and your next door neighbor doesn't even know who you are. This is true in the United States, but that's not true in France. In France, you have to, if you're going to be a success, you have to have a kind of local success. I don't know how it is in Catalonia or Spain, but you don't have a situation where you can be an internationally famous French philosopher and be unknown in France, or at least it's much less common than it is in the United States. Le Monde once had an article called Quine, Philosophe Inconnu. Quine, the unknown philosopher. I burst out laughing. He was the best known philosopher in the whole world. He just was not known on the rive gauche. He just was not, his work was not known in Paris. Anyway, I don't want to say more about this, but I do think there are interesting cultural differences between analytic philosophy and continental philosophy. And one is the attitude to science. I think that analytic philosophers, perhaps unconsciously, see their work as kind of a continuation of science. We're trying to state that, I mean, Quine was explicit about this. We're trying to state the same kind of truth that is stated in the sciences. It just tends to be more general. It's also where work more on conceptual issues. Whereas my experience with continental philosophers is that it's, they think of it as more close to literature. They think of it as not another branch of science, but they see it as having a literary aspect to it. And I once had a debate, well, a very peculiar debate, with a guy named Derrida. And this, it turned out that Michel hated Derrida much more than I ever did. I didn't have a feeling about Derrida one way or another. But he described Derrida's style as obscurantisme terroriste. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? Qu'est-ce que ça veut dire exactement? He said, well, look, he writes so badly that you can't understand it. That's the obscurantisme. And then when you criticize it, he says, vous m'avez mal compris, vous êtes idiot. That's the terrorist part. I don't know if I should do more about that, because there's a huge literature about something called a Searle Derrida debate. I never paid any attention to it. I wrote one thing about it, and then I wrote another article for the New York Review of Books about this movement in philosophy. But I don't know if I should write more about it. I think probably not. It's probably, you let these more preposterous intellectual movements die of their own accord. Unlike, say, artificial intelligence. Strong artificial intelligence doesn't die of its own accord, because it has big funding, it pretends to be a branch of science, it has technological implications, and they say absurdly false things. They say the mind just is a digital computer program, and that you can refute. And I like to refute that, because it only takes, as you know, it takes a few minutes to refute it. Okay, so what should we do in our last talk, our last lecture? Well, here are some topics. We could solve the problem of free will. That's kind of fun. We could explain the notion of the notion of political power. What is power? We could explain perception. I didn't really explain perception. I said a few words about it, but it might be interesting to say some more about perception. Well, those are three topics, but there are lots of others. But let's start, anyway, by talking a little bit about power, because Foucault wrote about power, and I don't understand his writing on this very well. He wrote about something called biopower, and I'll say a little bit about that. So how does the account that I gave you of social ontology, how does that relate to power? Well, I want to put forward a thesis, and the thesis is this, that in addition to the brute physical power that is wielded by armies and police forces, there is a kind of political power which is deontic, where people have to have some sort of commitment to the state, some sort of commitment to the organization that they live in. And I want to put forward as a possibility that what we should think of as political power is essentially deontic. Typically, the military, you have to have, as I said, a military and a police force in order to have a state. But if you only have the sort of power that you have in a prison or a concentration camp, it's not a political situation. A political situation must involve a sense of deontic powers, sense that there are constraints having to do with rights, duties, obligations, and so on, and that the citizen has a certain relationship to the state. So my view here differs from Carl Schmitt. Carl Schmitt, you remember, was the German theoretician. It's so interesting to me, Schmitt, because it's always puzzling to figure out how a nation as intelligent and well-educated as Germany could have gone under the control of the Nazis. And it's interesting how many serious thinkers were pro-Nazi. Now, Heidegger, famously, was a member of the Nazi party until the very end. But he's an odd case. I mean, it's hard to know. I can't imagine having a conversation with Heidegger. Whereas Carl Schmitt, he was more part of our conversation, and he said some things that are certainly false about democratic countries. He said that politics is based on the distinction between friend and enemy, between your friends and your enemies, and you want to kill your enemies. Well, that's not really true in democratic countries. The Republicans and the Democrats don't much like each other, and they really are enemies, but they don't want to kill each other. In the old days, before Newt Gingrich, after the tremendous battles, they'd all go out and have dinner together. I mean, it was perfectly easy to move from one party to another. So the friend-enemy distinction is not murderous in democratic societies. They don't really want to kill each other. They're hostile, and they do have the level of hostility now in the United States is much greater than it was traditionally, but they don't want to kill each other. And I think this is part of the fact that political power in a healthy society is deontic. If it's all brute force, it's no longer politics. You have to have some level of a political, it has to be some level of acceptance, recognition of the authority of the state, or you do not have a genuine political situation. Otherwise, it's just a terrorist situation. Now, Foucault had this notion of biopower, and it's an interesting notion, and the notion is that in fact there's a kind of invisible power that is pervasive in societies like ours, and it's the power that is exerted by the medical profession, by the educational system, And what it attempts to do is to normalize people. We're all supposed to fit a certain norm of mental health whereby we conform to certain a general background practices of the community. And that this is a much more insidious form of power than the kind of power that we're all familiar with from political philosophy discussions. Precisely because it's invisible. Biopower, he called it. Now, there are two constraints, it seems to me, that you ought to have in the discussion of power. And one constraint is you ought to be able to say exactly who exercises power over whom with respect to what. It's not enough to talk vaguely about power. You have to be able to talk about who has power over whom. And the secret of the more successful democracies is they do have power relations, but they're not transitive. A has power over B, B has power over C, but A does not have power over C. And that means you get what in the United States is called a system of checks and balances, whereby nobody has absolute power. It's a constant rearrangement and struggle. And I used to think this was kind of purely abstract textbook, but in fact, it's really important. It's very important in actual politics in the United States that nobody is sovereign. Nobody has absolute power over the country. They're constantly negotiating power relations. They're constantly struggling over who has power with respect to what. Obama had a huge majority in both houses, and yet he had enormous difficulty passing his health care, and it's still being negotiated and fought over. And that's a healthy fact, that you can say who has power over whom with respect to what, but you can't state it in a way that satisfies the traditional definition of sovereignty, whereby the Hobbesian sovereign has power over everyone in the society. So that's the first constraint you have to have in the discussion of power, is what I call the exactness constraint. You have to say who has power over whom with respect to what. And then there is the explicitness constraint, and that is power, if it's really exercised, has to be exercised intentionally. You see, if people find my body smell so disgusting that when I enter a room, they all leave, that's not an exercise of power. That's just an unfortunate effect. Whereas if I go in the room with the intention of making them leave, then it becomes an exercise of power. So there are two constraints on the discussion of power. It has to be, you have to be able to say who has power over whom with respect to what. And you have to be able to say that the power was exercised intentionally. Because, of course, there are lots of cases where people have power, but it's not, so to speak, intentionally exercised. The other people just go along with it. In 1948, the Russian troops massed on the border of what was then Czechoslovakia. They didn't invade. They didn't have to invade. The local people got the message, you better go along with us or we're in a position to invade you. And that, I think, is an intentional exercise of power. You can have intentional exercise of power where the threat of the exercise of power is itself an exercise of power. But that satisfies our intentionality constraint. That was done intentionally. And it satisfies the exactness constraint. What should we say about Foucault's biopower? Does it meet the intentionality constraint and the exactness constraint? Well, I think it does in a way, but you have to invoke what I call the background, this sort of background set of practices, and those exert enormous power. Let me give you some trivial examples. In my childhood, in my intellectual childhood, when I first started teaching in Berkeley, professors tended to dress a certain way, and students tended to dress a certain way. They weren't forced to, but it was a sort of expected pattern. Now, this has changed a lot. So, for example, a woman professor can go to class in a skirt and high heels, or she can go in blue jeans and running shoes and a sweatshirt. She has enormous freedom. I do not have that freedom. I cannot give a lecture in high heels, net stockings, and a mini skirt. If I did that, it would produce very strange reactions among my students. My God, we never knew this about him. Now, in what sense is power being exercised over me? Well, I don't want a lecture in high heels and a mini skirt, so there's no explicit exercise of power. All the same, there is a set of background practices. There are a set of background practices as to what is permissible and what's acceptable. And that seems to me to satisfy my definition where you require explicitness and exactness. Why? Because where the background is concerned, anybody can exercise power over anybody. That is, there's a pervasive set of presuppositions about what is acceptable, what sorts of things you can do, and what sorts of things you can't do. And those, I think, constitute a form of power. What exactly is the imperative? What is it exactly is the content of the exercise of power? And the content is conform. Conform to the norms of the community. And I'm not sure how much a community, how the communities can survive if there is no conformity. I mean, it's an interesting question. See, in the 1960s, there was a period when people felt, well, we don't have to conform. We can go to class with any clothes we want or with no clothes. It doesn't matter. We can do anything we want. But it was not successful. It did not produce a healthy society, the total absence of constraints. And it's very interesting, in that period in California, there were a series of entities formed. I'm reluctant to call them organizations. There were a series of communes, and people went to live out in California, like, I guess, Catalonia has lots of forests and lots of mountains and lots of open land. So these people went out and lived in the woods in what were called communes. And they thought, at last, we have found freedom. Now, it's very interesting. I'd like to see a study of these. They all died. The communes all died. They did not keep going indefinitely. But the ones that survived longest, the ones that kept going longer than any others, and this is a very fascinating point, the longest surviving communes all had one thing in common. They were led by a dominant male. It's as if these liberated children of the 1960s reverted to a hunter-gatherer, biologically primitive form of existence, where the dominant male, the alpha male, dominated the rest of the tribe. What I'm trying to say is, I think that in the romantic philosophy, where we think if only we could liberate ourselves from all of the conventions that bind us, from the systems of status functions that so constrain us, there is a fantasy that people have that if they could liberate themselves from all of that, they would have a much freer or more fulfilling form of existence. And this came to fruition in California in the 1960s. And I will tell you, the 1960s were absolutely dreadful. There is now an attempt to sentimentalize us. It's the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement, and I was involved in that a mere 50 years ago. And the Americans have a genius, and that's this. If a threatening movement succeeds, what we do is pretend it's what we wanted all along. That's what we wanted all along, you see. And so the FSM, the free speech movement, is now celebrated in Berkeley. People who would have hated us make speeches saying what a wonderful expression of youthful idealism this was. There's even an FSM coffee shop There's a free speech movement coffee shop. You want to see the effect of the FSM? There's a photograph of me leading a march holding a huge sign that says free speech. And I'm wearing my best Oxford suit. This is a long time ago. And in a way, this is very healthy, because instead of recognizing this really was a threat to the power structure of the universities, we just think, wasn't it wonderful? It's what we always wanted. You see, it took the French 200 years to accept the French Revolution. And indeed, there are still old families in Paris who cannot accept the French Revolution. It's a disaster, you see. Well, Americans, if it succeeds, it's really what we wanted. It's what we wanted. And that means it's assimilable. You can digest it, you can assimilate it. Anyway, so the point I'm making now is that, three points. One, political power has to be deontic. There has to be an element of deontic. If it's just the power of the concentration camp, then it's not political power. The power of the concentration camp guards is not political power. It's brute military power. There has to be some level of acceptance. And the interesting thing is how much totalitarian states are insecure. See, Stalin and Hitler had more power than anybody else in Europe. They never felt that. They were desperately insecure. They were constantly obsessed with being overthrown. As we know, Stalin had all of his best friends killed precisely because he was afraid they might be a threat to his power. Okay, so that's the first thing. You have to have some level of deontology. And the second thing is that if you consider how power is exercised, then you have to be able to say what exactly is the power that's exercised and over whom is it exercised. But if you then go all the way down and look at the more basic structures of society, what you find is that, I'm not sure that this is what Foucault intended, but it's a thought that he inspired in me, and that is that you do have what I would call background power, where there are background presuppositions where conformity can be imposed by anybody on anybody. This is a power that everybody has over everybody, and it's simply the power to insist on conformity, and the penalty for violating constraints. For violating these constraints is that you're in various ways cast out of the regular social networks. Okay, so I'm almost tempted to stop for questions about that because we don't have an awful. How are we now? It's not time for a break, or is it?
As you wish. I mean, you're.
Well, okay. This is our last session. I want to cover a whole lot of topics. I'd like to talk about free will, and I'd like to talk about other things besides just power. So why don't we stop and have questions, and then I'll go on and talk about free will. Okay. So let's take questions about what I said about power. The basic point is that political power has to be deontic. It's not. Carl Schmitt was wrong. That's all about wanting to kill friends and enemies and wanting to kill other people. There has to be some level of acceptance. But secondly, even within that structure, you have to have a explicitness and exactness. It has to be intentional. It has to be intentional exercise of power. And then a third, the whole thing rests on a background conformity. It rests on the fact that there are in societies a set of inexplicit norms of conformity that we all abide by more or less unconsciously. When I first came to Spain under Franco, it was a different society altogether. The dominating social figure on the streets was El Paro. You probably don't even know what this means, but it meant the Guardia Civil, the pair of guys who were police, armed policemen who walked together and enforced order. And there's no question that they intended to enforce a kind of order, and that this was, this is what the Falange tried to achieve, was complete domination. Okay, let's do questions about that. Yeah.
So political power has to be deontic, and it has at least to constrain, exactness constraint, and explicitness constraint.
Or intentionality constraint. The explicitness and the intentionality constraint. If you're talking about actual exercise of power, you have to be able to say who has power over whom with respect to what. It won't just do to talk vaguely about power. And then if it's an exercise of power, it has to be intentional. You have to intend it as an exercise.
Okay, so then think of a father.
Yeah.
A father and the structure of a family.
Yeah.
Then you have the ontic.
Yes.
There's some deontic, but
yeah.
father
already is recognized.
Yeah. And there seems to be also this exactness and this explicitness constraint.
Yes.
Also,
he can tell you what time you have to go to bed.
Yeah.
And when you have to do your homework.
Yeah.
So
is that a political institution, family?
Yeah. It is a kind of political institution because the power is deontic and it's very explicit. It's explicit who gets to decide what. It rests on some level of acceptance.
So you would say that family is a political institution?
Yeah, of a sort. I mean, it's biologically based, but the thing is, see, the account that I gave you of society says that the social institutions tend to grow out of more biologically primitive phenomena. So the family as a social institution grows out of the biology of pair bonding and producing babies. See, humans, unlike some species, require an enormous amount of care for their infants. You can't just abandon the infants, they'll die. So the human has to care for the infant for a long time. It works best if there's some social organization for doing that. And the institution that has evolved is the family, where the family is a social institution in my sense. It's a system of deontic powers, but it grows out of more biologically basic phenomena in the same way that a private property is the institution that grows out of more primitive biological phenomena where people just possess objects, where they just have a kind of yay mining kite. This is mine and that's yours. And then larger communities grow out of more primitive hunter-gatherer social arrangements where there actually is a position of leadership and a position of some sort of a deontology within the community. Very interesting to study hunter-gatherer communities because it turns out the hunters are always the men and the gatherers are always the women. And that doesn't mean we're born to hunt or to gather, but it does mean in that environment there is a natural tendency of the men to go out and try and hunt the animals and the women to gather such food as is available. Yeah. Yes. Nicole.
Will you talk more about, you mentioned briefly the other day about positive and negative powers.
Yes.
Are there any rhyme or reason to that kind of structure? Are there more negative?
Yeah.
Are there more negative sort of?
Okay, well, this is another topic I want to talk about. And we really ought to try to save some time today. And that is human rights. And there is a major shift in our culture, and that's this. Here's a fascinating idea. If you look at all of the deontic rights that people have, I have rights as a father, as a husband, as a professor, as a citizen, as a licensed driver, I have rights, duties, and obligations. Somebody in the Enlightenment, I think it was probably before the 18th century, but not much before, got the idea you have rights just in virtue of being a human being. So your rights are not just the rights you have within an institutional structure, but in the X counts as Y in C. Y is human. See, in most of these things, you count as a property owner, you count as a citizen, you count as a professor. But here, just being a human, and I don't know what you have over here, humans count as humans, and therefore they have human rights. And this is a revolutionary idea. I don't know who was the first person to think of it. Was it Hugo Grotius? I mean, it'd be interesting to know who was the first person to think of the idea of universal human rights. Now you could say, well, it goes back to the ancient Greeks, but not in this peculiar way of the European Enlightenment. Or you could say, well, the Christian religion thought everybody had human rights because God created them all. I think there's something special about the Enlightenment, and the United States was based on this assumption that there is an inventory of universal human rights. And that's an amazing idea, that there are rights you have just in virtue of being a human being, and governments are not allowed to interfere with those rights. Now, there have always been skeptics. Jeremy Bentham thought the whole idea was ridiculous. The idea of human rights is nonsense, and the idea of universal human rights that are unimpeachable by states, he said that's nonsense on stilts. I mean, stilts, you know, is the thing you walk around on with the sticks that attach to your legs. And Bentham said the only rights that make any sense are rights that are guaranteed by laws. Now, I think this is not a substantive dispute. It's about how we choose to use the word. But I think it's perfectly legitimate to say, if you can talk about my rights as a citizen, or my rights as a professor, or my rights as a driver in the state of California, then I think it makes sense to talk about my rights as a human being, a revolutionary idea in the 18th century. However, there's a very subtle shift, which Nicole's question gets at, and that is, prior to the 20th century, the universal human rights were pretty much negative. That is to say, you're left alone. So the right to free speech just means I have a right to be left alone to say what I want to say. The right of free association means I have the right to associate with anybody. The right of freedom of religion means I have a right to participate in any religion or no religion. All of those are negative. However, there has grown up a new doctrine, positive rights. And I think the worst statement of this is in the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1945. And there they say such things as, every human being has a right to adequate housing. Adequate housing? Who the hell is going to provide adequate housing for everybody in the Amazon basin? Now, why is this puzzling? Well, here is the point. Every right implies an obligation. So if you have a right, it's a right against somebody. And the person you have the right against is under an obligation to do certain things. So here is the equation. X has right. R implies X has R against Y, and that implies Y is under an obligation. Now, for negative rights, the obligation is just not to interfere with the exercise of the right. So the universal right to free speech just means that everybody is under an obligation to allow me to say what I want to say. But if you say there are positive rights, then you're saying everybody is under an obligation to do some positive act which will enable the fulfillment of the right. So if you say everybody has a right to free speech, that's a negative right. It just means everybody is under an obligation to let me alone to say what I want to say. If you say, I have a universal human right to adequate housing, you're saying everybody in the world is under an obligation to provide me with adequate housing. And that, I think, is crazy. There aren't enough resources to go around to provide adequate housing for everybody. So whenever you talk about universal human rights, you have to talk about who has what right exactly and whom do they have it against. Universal human rights are rights against everybody. Now, if the state of California decides every citizen of California has a right to adequate housing, that seems to me perfectly reasonable. That's a democratic decision. But the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, I think, is a very irresponsible document because it says that we're all under an obligation to provide adequate housing for everybody in the world, and we just don't have the resources for that. We're all under an obligation to provide adequate health care and education for everybody in the world. And again, I don't think we have the resources for that. Now, notice two things I'm not saying. Everybody has the right to seek adequate housing and to seek an education. That seems to me legitimate. But it is a very peculiar document to say everybody in the world is under an obligation to provide adequate housing for everybody and to provide adequate health care for everybody and to provide an adequate education for everybody. There aren't enough resources for that. So that leads me to think there aren't any universal positive human rights. One exception I can think of, and that is, I think if your life is threatened immediately, you have a right. There's a universal human right. We're all under an obligation to help the person who is threatened. So if we see a guy run over by a car in Girona, I think there is a universal obligation to try to help to save the guy's life. Why? Why should there be an exception for the right to life? Well, roughly speaking, because you can't have any rights if you're not alive. That's the condition of exercising any rights at all. So the precondition of every right, the right to free speech, the right to freedom of religion, the right to free elections, the precondition is that there should be a life. And that means that we are under an obligation to try to save lives of people whom we can affect, where we can effectively save the life. Now that doesn't mean I'm under an obligation to save the life of anybody who's hit by a car in Nairobi. It's out of my scope. But if there is somebody whose life I can save, who is right here and now under danger of losing their life, then I think we are under an obligation to try to help as a person. And that the implication of that is a universal human right. So here's I am. It's an intellectually uncomfortable position, but here's how it goes. Rights are a species of deontic power. Normally, deontic powers apply to institutions. But in the 18th century, some genius got the idea that the Y term is just being a human, that you have rights just in virtue of being a human. And I think that makes good sense. I think we do have rights just in virtue of being human. And I'll give you an inventory in a minute. But now then you have to distinguish between positive rights, where everybody's under an obligation to do something, and negative rights, where all I have to do is leave you alone. You can exercise your free speech and join your friends and join what religion you like. But if you say, no, you have a universal human right to adequate housing, then I'm under an obligation to help provide you adequate housing, and I don't think I am. I don't think there are any positive human rights, with one exception. So I'm in a kind of intellectually uncomfortable position. I have to make this exception for the right to life and safety, and there I think that is a universal positive human right. So it's kind of a messy intellectual situation. I think the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a very irresponsible document. Now, fortunately, no one pays any attention to it. Once in a while, we scream at the Chinese or the Russians that they're violating it. But by and large, nobody pays any attention to it, so it doesn't much matter. But the basic assumption behind it is a fallacy. And it's a fallacy that the inventory of rights includes both universal human rights, includes both a lot of negative rights, free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of association, and a lot of positive rights, the right to adequate housing, adequate health care. The idea that everybody in the universe is entitled to a split-level ranch house seems to me not a serious prospect, just because there aren't that much resources to go around. Okay, so that's a very good question, and I hope I've answered that, because this is something I wanted to talk about anyway, is human rights. Because human rights are a special category of deontic powers, but they're, in this case, deontic powers that you have, not in virtue of being a member of a separate institution, of a family or university, but just in virtue of being a human. It's a great idea. Now the next step is, what's the inventory? What are the what's the list of universal human rights? I'm going to give you that in a minute, but let's take more questions. Yeah.
I have four short comments. These are all topics that interest me the most. So, but the last will pertain to human rights. We may go on then. First, with regard to the concentration camp.
Yeah.
I don't think we only have brute force there.
Yeah.
I think one of the points of the concentration camp was to produce some kind of acceptance. And if nothing else, you had this intermediate level of prisoners who were put in positions of power to watch over other prisoners.
So there
was a level of acceptance.
They had a minimal level of social structure,
yeah,
even within the concentration camp. Yeah.
Second thing, Schmidt's distinction, friend-enemy. I think the example you gave is not the right one, because that's precisely what he criticizes. On the level of nation states, in parliamentary democracies,
yeah,
he says you don't have power relations, you don't have the political struggles, so they're not political.
Yeah.
Where you have the right level of the conflict, of the political conflict, is at the international level between states.
Yeah.
Third thing, universal. When you use universal human rights, I think you don't use them in the way that they are usually thought of. Usually when you say that a right is universal, it's thought of as everyone has that right. Not that you have it against everyone,
yeah,
but that each individual has it.
Yeah. What's it mean? See, I want to say, what it means to say you have a right is to say that somebody's under an obligation to you. Because without the obligation, the right is just a word. Okay, so I have a right to own a fast car. Well, against whom is this right? I think it makes no sense to talk about rights. For every right, there's somebody against whom you have the right. It may be a large number of people or a single individual. If I have my right to park my car in your driveway, then you're under an obligation to let me allow me to park my car in your driveway. So I don't think you can make sense of rights without saying against whom you have the right. But anyway, you had three objections. I want to answer each of them. Yeah.
No. With regard to this, I don't think the individual who is under the obligation needs to be specified. It needs to be specifiable, but it needn't be specific. I think so. Anyway, the last thing, I think that the rhetorics and the philosophy of universal human rights is that you have them in virtue of being human. But if nothing else, Hannah Arendt showed that this is not the case. And what is missing, I think, in this account is the intermediate level of the status, of another status, which is being the subject of law.
Yeah.
So that's something that usually is missing. And when this legal subjectivity is taken away, then you have a problem. So this is what usually is missing.
But okay, but this was, the idea was that this was at the founding of the United Nations, that these universal human rights were promulgated. And the idea was that all of the states would agree that these were universal human rights. And it didn't work.
Yeah, but everyone has them. And there is an Article 6, I think, or 9, which talks about the right of everyone to have their legal capacity recognized.
Yeah. The point, however, that I'm making is that many of the rights guaranteed by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights are meaningless because there is no specification as who's under an obligation to provide them and what they're supposed to do to provide them. And the states that undertake to do this can't provide. That's Brazil can't provide adequate housing for everybody in the Amazon Basin. They don't have that kind of resources. But so, do you agree with me that there's a distinction between positive and negative rights? Okay, if you agree with that, then my question is, are there universal human rights? I think there are. And then the question is, are there universal positive human rights? And there I can only find one, and that's a special case. What's the ground for the others? Well, let me answer your other objections first. In a concentration camp, do you have a system of deontology? Well, maybe at some level you do, but the whole system is based on terror. It's based on fear. And that's shown by the fact the moment the gates open, everybody flees. I mean, they don't. It's not like living in an actual state where people accept the system of the state. Even in states that are pretty oppressive, people tend to accept the state. But that wasn't true in the concentration camps. So we could argue about the facts of concentration camps. But the second point about Carl Schmitt, that this is about the relation between states and not politics within the state, seems to me false about the relationship between states. In the United States, we have conflicts with many other countries, but we don't want to destroy. I mean, we have conflicts with the British, for example, over imports and exports. But we don't want to kill them, and they don't want to kill us, as far as I know. So the point that I was making about Carl Schmitt, namely that he has an extremely impoverished conception of the friend-enemy distinction, where he says you have to want to kill your enemies, that's not true. Within democratic societies and among democratic societies, it's an odd fact. Democratic societies almost never have war with other democratic societies. It's hard to think of any examples where two democracies went to war with each other. And this, by the way, is the background. Hitler was always amazed that the United States did not seek Anschluss with Canada. Why don't we annex Canada? Now, if you told Americans we're going to annex Canada, they'd burst out laughing. It just would be a big joke. We don't want Anschluss with Canada, and they don't want Anschluss with us. It wasn't like Germany and Austria. They speak our language, and they have many same institutions, but it's a background, a presupposition that these are independent states. Okay, so I've answered the point about the concentration camp and about Carl Schmitt. But about human rights, I think there's a deep point here, and that is if you just say, I have a right, well, there is a use of that where people mean, it would be very nice if. It would be very nice if everybody had adequate housing and everybody had a good education, but that's not enough for a right. For a right, it has to be enforceable. And for there to be enforceable, there have to be people who are under an obligation to recognize the right. So the account of rights that I'm giving you is that rights are a species of deontic powers. Typically, they exist within pre-existing institutions. But there was a wonderful invention in the Enlightenment, universal human rights, where you have right just in virtue of being a human. Okay, now are there any, really? I mean, can we give an inventory of negative rights and why? Why are something rights and not others? Well, let me start. One, the right to free expression. I think that is a universal human right. Why? How are we doing for time? Can we go for another few minutes before we break?
As you wish.
Okay, let's go for a few minutes and then we'll have our break. The right to free expression, I think, is a universal human right. Why? What's the ground for saying that is a universal human right? Well, we are speech act performing animals. See, there are two standard answers to that are both false. One is the right to free speech is utilitarian. If you have the right to the extent that it benefits people. Sometimes it doesn't benefit people. You still have the right, even if you say things that are stupid, vulgar, unintelligent, irrelevant, or critical of my philosophy. you still have the right, even though you may not have a utilitarian advantage to the exercise of the right. And I want to say there are two reasons for that. One is it's part of your nature as a human being that you need to express yourself. You do not have a full human life if you don't have free expression, if you cannot express yourself. And secondly, we think this is valuable. See, there are other biologically basic phenomena which we don't think are valuable. So, for example, adolescent boys like to beat up on other adolescent boys, presumably in competition for adolescent girls. I don't know why, but they do. Now, the right of adolescent boys to practice violence on other adolescent boys is not a universal human right. There's no special value to it. Whereas free speech, we think is valuable. We think it's precious that people should be able to express themselves. So I think the right to free speech is a universal human right, and I can give you the grounds for that. Now the model here that I just gave you is this a negative right, and the basis of the right, there has to be two bases for the right. There has to be something about our nature that the right follows from. And secondly, that has to be a valuable part of our nature. Now, it's very unfashionable in philosophy to talk about human nature. I mean, it has such a sordid history that you can see why it's unfashionable. But I think you cannot make sense of human rights without a conception of human nature. And the universal human rights are things which is in our nature to do and in our nature to value. But we have to have independently a claim that they are in fact valuable, that it is a good thing that human beings should be able to express themselves, that they don't reach full development as human beings unless they have a capacity for self-expression. Okay, now give me that, and then I can give you a bunch of other universal human rights. A second universal human right is the right to free association, is the right to associate with other people that I want to associate with. Okay, so we got two. A third universal human right is, roughly speaking, the right to have the convictions you wish to have. We normally think of this as religion. We normally think of it as freedom of religion. But just to have the philosophical or scientific convictions that you have, freedom of opinion. So I've given you freedom of speech, freedom of association, and freedom of opinion as three basic human rights, all justified by the same consideration, a conception of human right and nature and a conception of value. Now notice, in order to identify these, you have to identify specific areas of human concern. We don't have to say there's a universal human right to move your arms around because nobody's interfering with that. If they were, we might say, okay, universal human right to move your arms around. However, I want to say there are some changes going on in the world that make me think we need a richer conception of human rights. One is this. I think there's a right to silence, at least some part of the day. And this is being persistently invaded. You don't suffer so much in Girona as people suffer in New York City, for example, or in Rome. But I think the right to silence, at least some part of the day, is a universal human right. You can't flourish without some degree of silence, and you can't really, well, you can't be healthy. Roman motorcycles are the worst, but there are others. We have now got mechanical noise-making which exceeds any previous period in human history. People can make a hell of a lot of racket with mechanical assistance. And I would want to argue that it is a universal human right that we should have at least some periods of silence. So I think the right to associate, the right to express yourself, the right to have freedom of opinion, and the right to be free of the imposition of other people's noise-making apparatus, that would be a beginning of an inventory of human rights. Now, what are some more? I mean, there must be lots of others. Other questions about all this and about what I said earlier as well. Let's have more questions.
I mean,
those are very good questions.
Maybe a couple of them and we stop and then
okay.
A couple more questions
and then we stop. Yes.
Yeah, what would be a positive human right?
What would be what?
Because what you said, I understand what the ones you mentioned before were the negative.
Yeah, all of these rights I gave you are negative.
What would be the positive?
Well, I can only think of one positive human right, and that's the right to life. And other people, if given the opportunity, I think are under an obligation to enable me to survive. You see, if a guy is without a house, I don't think I am under an obligation to provide him a house. But if a guy is dying on the street, he's hit by a car, I think I'm under an obligation to try to save his life if I can. Now, that I feel this is uncomfortable, because I would like to be able to say there are no positive rights, there are only negative rights, but this one I think I can probably justify upon the grounds that a precondition of having any rights at all is that you're alive. So you have a positive right to life and safety, but that's the only one I can think of, which is a positive right. But that you got a positive right to a nice house, a good higher education, I think individual states might provide those, and I think a good idea if they do provide those. I mean, in California, we used to have universal right to free education. That was wonderful when I first moved there. Now, the taxpayers don't want to pay for it. Now, they've suddenly got the idea, the people who benefit from these university degrees are the students. Let them pay for it. So this is a major shift. But there, the distinction in saying that the state can, if it wants to, guarantee these rights, these positive rights, and then saying all human beings are under an obligation to provide these for all other human beings, that seems to me a philosophical mistake. Okay, other questions? Any other?
How about animal rights?
Animal rights, okay. Now, here's my problem. I would have afraid to think about animal rights for a very simple reason. I fear if I thought hard about animal rights, I'd have to become a vegetarian. I'd have to. And I, you know, there's some inconsistencies that I've lived with so long, it's very hard to give them up. And it's true, if somebody wanted to eat Tarski, my dog, I'd kill him. I mean, eating Tarski. But what's the big difference between Tarski and the poor little pig that I ate last night? I don't even want to think about it. I'm deeply convinced that if we thought hard about animal rights, why shouldn't animals have rights? They're conscious.
Yeah.
They can suffer. They can flourish. And I think that case for animal rights is overwhelming. It's just if we went carried it through to the end, we'd have to give up eating meat. And I'm reluctant to do that. I'm about to go out and have another hamburger or something for lunch, but I think that's probably correct. So the short answer to your question is, of course animals have rights, because they can flourish and they can suffer. They're conscious. That's my great dividing line. You see, I doubt if plants have rights. Okay. It's like grass in my lawn have rights. Chopped up by the lawnmower. I don't think. The grass and the plants have any rights, because they're not conscious. But animals definitely are conscious. And there is a very good author in English. He's South African, and his name is... Is that how he spells it?
Kutsi.
What is he? Like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, this guy's terrific. He really is, in spite of the fact that he's won the Nobel Prize for Literature and he's written a lot of great books, he's actually pretty talented. Okay, he is actually a gifted writer. And some of the most eloquent writings against eating meat are in his works. And he says, if you are shocked by the thought of the trains carrying innocent victims to Auschwitz, remember, every night in Spain and the United States, trains are carrying thousands of animals to the Auschwitz or the abattoir. So where they're going to be murdered brutally, and then we're going to serve them. They serve them on the next day for dinner. It does sound disgusting, actually, if you describe it, but I'm afraid I'm going to go out and have meat for dinner tonight. But at any rate, this guy makes a very powerful case. It's an odd thing. I never was aware of how to pronounce his name, but I had a kid in my class with the same name, and I meant to ask him how to pronounce it, a South African kid. Turns out it was his son. I never met the kid until after he left Berkeley. I had his son in my class and didn't even know it. But in any case, he is an extremely... Many of his novels exasperate me because he doesn't discuss what I want him to discuss. But he is rather good. He's maybe the best little novelist. Okay, any other questions now?
Well, let's leave it. If there is any question, maybe we leave it for the second half.
So we'll have our break now.
No break.
Okay. Terrific.
Thank you.